Matt's very kindly agreed to meet me up at his home in Stourbridge, and I can't be here today to see him. And he's very kindly agreed to talk to me about the events of 1942, plus his career with Bomber Command as well. We've already spoken quite a bit this afternoon, but now first and tell me a little bit about that night of the 31st of January 1942. So, if you'd like to tell me, Bert, what you remember first of all on that night.
Well, first of all, I said, bear in mind, we were carrying this special bus. So, theoretically, I say no more, what we were told, the raid would commence at 8 o'clock, and it would not just be fireproof, other troops would be involved. I think some Whitlers were going over, some Blenheims were going over. Then they would attack from 8 o'clock until 8:25. They would then leave the target, climb and crisscross the target for us to go in underneath them at 8:28. We were given 2 minutes on and off target, 8:28 to 8:30. Now, as you've seen from the logbook, we were 35, 45 minutes later taking off. That's why I said to you, we couldn't believe we weren't recalled. But we weren't recalled, so okay. And we went in as we were ordered to go in, and we were combed by searchlights immediately. We were hit by everything but the bloody kitchen sink. But, as I said, the skipper flew south to north, so that we were coming toward, across Cape of France, north to England. And we bombed on the way through over the harbour. We'd lost one engine, the other one was petering out. We were gradually getting lower and lower and lower, and eventually we just buried into the sea. As I said, Ron Fraser made a marvellous landing, got us out. I don't mind saying now, I was petrified because I couldn't swim. But I didn't realise then, but now I know, I got my parachute on. So when I got, you've seen the plan of the aircraft, I got to get from the radio operator's desk down to the pilot's seat, and Ron Fraser, in fact, was still in his seat when he lifted me onto the arm of the seat out through the hatch, and so I was in the seat and he came out, and I dock paddled to the dinghy. I remember seeing the dinghy blowing up, floating, when I got out, and then I looked down the fuselage and I could see my tail gunner, Joe Walsh, standing in the doorway as though it was Sunday afternoon, and he decides to swim up to the dinghy. And I looked for Ron, my skipper, and he was out on the front turret. And he called me, so I went with him, to him. And in the turret was our front gunner, who wasn't moving, so we forced the turret round and tried to lift him by the straps, but he didn't move at all.
So the aircraft was still floating?
It floated, in fact, for 90 seconds.
Oh, right.
And that was what we were told, it was floating for 90 seconds. Yeah. And of course, by this time, the nose was starting to dip, so we had to leave him. So this poor old Canadian, we assumed was dead in the turret. I think I told you that during the panic when we were being hit over the target, we got a second pilot on his second trip, and he lost his nerve, and Ron Fraser, I could see, now pushed him out of the way, you see, and that was the last we saw of him. We haven't got a clue what happened to him, but in those reports you've sent me, it does say a parachute was seen. Now that was the first time I'd even got a thought of what happened to him. So it could be he bailed out. If he did, he wouldn't have a cat in hell's chance. Because the most we were was 2,000 feet. That was the highest we were. Anyway, that meant then that the six of us were out in the dinghy. You know, it wasn't very warm.
So you weren't very far off the French coast.
14 miles we crushed.
Right.
And after we sorted ourselves out, typical RAF, of course, around dinghy, 12 feet across, with 18-inch walls. Circle, and they give you one glove paddle. It's a glove, like a glove you put over your hand,
yes,
and it was, and that was to paddle. and Dinky, you
yeah,
suppose.
Yeah, one of them.
And so, I began, Bill, I think, Bill Shoddick, was paddling. So, this, don't forget, this is 11 o'clock time, half past 10, 11 o'clock time of the Sunday night. And we daily turned, the skippers were taking turns to paddle, which we did. Then as it became daylight, I'm sitting there, Joel Walsh was sitting on one wall, and he said, "What's this?" And it's a piece of cord in the water. So it pulled, and it's anchored down in the water. As he starts to pull, the skipper said, "Bloody hell." Our CO had a theory. A lot of crews were lost, he believed, by one, they sent their SOS out, then they drifted. So when the rescue planes went for them, they weren't there. So his theory had a length of twine long enough to cover any sea we flew over, the depth of any sea we flew over, so that we would be anchored till we could sort ourselves out, and we'd got an advantage. Anyway, the rate, I mean, you heard me say we were combed by searchlights.
Yeah.
Now, the theory the Germans had on any of their major cities or industrial areas was there would be a huge ring of searchlights. I would guess 50 miles across from one side to the other. So that when the raids came, they searched.
Yeah.
Then closer in, there would be a smaller ring of searchlights. And finally, a third ring, quite tightly packed. Now, they were controlled by what was called each of these rings was controlled by a master beam. And once the master beam got onto the aircraft, all the rest of this
right, I see.
And
yeah.
That's what you were called coned. You were coned by them,
right.
You see.
So you couldn't escape then?
And, well, you were lucky if you could.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were coned, and we didn't realize, I mean, shall I say, we were a bit busy in the aircraft.
Yeah.
So bear in mind, we're at 2,000 feet. They could hit us with bloody pea shooters.
Yeah.
We didn't have a cat in our chance, really. We knew we'd got to go down. So, that was it. But it right over. Next dawn broke on the Sunday morning. And we settled ourselves down, found the survival box, Cadbury's chocolate. But there were one or two items in there which we didn't have. And lo and behold, we suddenly hear an engine. And he said, "Messerschmitt decides to have some gunnery practice on this red ring in the sea. Now, obviously, we've got to dive over the side and let it pass." And that happened a couple of times.
Oh, right.
Which, incidentally, none of us blamed. Because we no doubt that our lads did it out to them.
Yeah.
It could be an empty dinghy.
Yeah.
So they got target practice.
Yeah. So they got close enough to know that you were British airmen that hit the Messerschmitt. Obviously knew you were,
well,
you were British.
Bear in mind, he'd probably been told
right
there we'd been
right,
down, or an
yeah,
aircraft had been
yeah,
down
yeah,
at that time,
yeah,
you see.
Yeah.
And that was a bit naughty. And then Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Monday morning we drifted into the French coast. And I remember clambering out onto the rocks.
So you had no idea you were drifting towards the French coast?
We didn't know where we were.
No,
a coastline.
Yeah.
We knew it wasn't England, by the way.
Yeah.
It was
too
far away.
Yeah.
And then we tried to destroy the dinghy, but we couldn't. We hadn't got a 9mm, but we did our best. And then we heard cries, and it was the local German army had come down
right.
The ocean.
Yeah.
It's difficult, of course.
So did you, obviously you realised that when you saw the coast, you knew it was the French coast.
Oh, yeah.
And you knew that as soon as the dinghy landed on the beach, that was it. You'd be captured, and unless...
It would be a matter of time.
So you resigned to...
They came down with Tommy guns and so. And incidentally, they were all right.
Yes.
They didn't make any noise. Just, you know, stick your hands up in the air.
Yeah.
And they took us up to a hut on the... because there were six of us in this hut. Then after a time, we heard a lorry, or heavy vehicle, pull up outside. And it was a Luftwaffe lorry. and they took us to the nearest Luftwaffe unit,
right.
You see.
Right. So you'd be prisoners of the Luftwaffe as opposed to the...
Oh, the army.
The Wehrmacht.
That's right.
The
they were handed over to Luftwaffe.
Yeah, yeah.
And they took us into what was very little different from one of our own wards.
Yes.
On the camp.
Yes.
And they spaced us 10 yards apart, I suppose, the six of us. Let us get clothed, they let us have a bath, and so forth. Let's get them dressed while they have a bath. And in bed.
Yes.
And then not long after, the doors open and this doctor comes.
Yes.
Who recognised the skipper.
Good.
Just like that.
Yeah. But were any of you actually injured?
No.
There's no injuries?
No, we lost two.
Yes.
No doubt about the front gunner.
Yes. Yes. But you saw him go...
Oh, yeah. Well, he's in the nose.
Yeah.
And Ron and I both pulled as hard as he could, his straps.
Yeah.
And if you've been pulled, you try and make some effort.
Yes, yeah.
He'd move a muscle.
But the other chap, you never saw again after?
We got no idea. And it wasn't until I read that account of yours, where it said a parachute was seen, that I realised he must have got
out. Yes, yes.
He must have tried to get out anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
But, It was a merry little evening, you know.
Yes. It mentions here, it says that you were, it says that your aircraft clipped a balloon cable. Was that right?
I don't know.
No.
When I read that...
I wonder where they got that from.
I never realised we clipped a balloon cable.
No.
But I don't know whether you know, but on the front of the wings of Manchester, anyway, they were balloon cutters.
Oh.
They were... An oblong blade with a hole in the middle.
Right.
And they were fitted about a yard apart.
Right.
And the theory was, if the wing hit the blue cable, it would go one side or the other.
Oh, I see.
Into
right.
one blade
oh,
or the other.
Yeah, yeah.
You see.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
there were two of these pairs on each wing. Mm. And okay, they said we hit a blue cable and got it.
Mm.
So be it.
Yeah.
But I certainly didn't believe it. Anyway, I was... got other things to do with
it. Yes.
It's the same of life.
Yeah. I don't know where they get this information.
No.
Perhaps
incidentally, what I meant to tell you about the combing, you see. When you're bombing, you see somebody coned and you go in. Because while they're shooting at him up there, they ain't bloody shooting at you.
Right.
And I mean, that was the rule of survival.
Right.
So that poor bugger's coned. But all the service guys, all the flak,
you take advantage of that. And you
don't.
Have to, yeah.
It's human nature.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
There's nothing heroic or cowardly about that.
No.
Somebody would try to do the same and we would go.
Yes.
Except all I'm saying is we were so low.
Yes.
I could say they could do it less.
So that coning only worked on one aircraft at a time. They couldn't they couldn't focus on home on more than one.
No, in fairness, the master beam found the aircraft.
Yeah.
Then the ring circled. The master beam then moved elsewhere.
Right,
and if he found a second one, part of the circle would come in on that one.
Right, right.
But they only really contact on one at a time
to
shoot that one down.
So you had to move quickly then when you saw an aircraft.
Well, you took it back. Yeah. Oh, yes, to get in.
Get in, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. But again, I mean, you did it on the theory.
Yeah.
While they're looking after him, they ain't looking after me.
Yes.
That was the theory you used.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just, everybody did it. There was no shame or pride in it.
No.
Poor bugger. He scored.
Yeah.
We're going in.
Yeah. And somewhere like Brest, of course, you knew that there'd be these intense searchlights.
Oh.
You knew there'd be lots of flak. So, because they're important. They're important targets.
Oh, they mentioned there was one which was more heavily defended than Brest. Now, I can't remember which it was, but Brest was very heavily.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they were three of his capital
ships. Oh, the master one, the Charnel's Knight now, and the Oregon.
Yes.
The pocket battleship.
Yeah.
I mean, they were miniature battleships.
Yeah.
As powerful as any of our big, the Hoder, any of those.
Yeah.
As powerful in arms.
Yeah.
But not nearly the size.
Yeah. Well, I was reading up on this, and apparently the plan was, Hitler's plan was, for the Scharnhorst and the Eisenhower to come out of Brest and join up with the Bismarck to start attacking the convoys, Atlantic convoys.
But
of course, this meant that so they couldn't do that.
That's right.
So Bismarck had to go alone. Went with the Eugen, and of course they sank the Hood first, and then it was sunk as well. But these two here would have been part of that.
Oh yes,
so they'd
have been a combo.
They'd been a serious threat, wouldn't they? Those three
It would have, had the situation been reversed, it would have made a major conquest if we'd have hit them.
Yes, oh yes.
You know, even disabled them, never mind destroyed them.
Yes,
but,
yes.
The fortifications at present were
tremendous. Yes, I imagine. Tremendous. Yeah. So anyway, so back in occupied France again, you were in the German hospital.
That's right. And
this doctor came in.
Yeah. And on the first bed inside the ward, it was my skipper. Right, and the doctor came in. He got the people with white coats and turns round to look at Ron, walks toward him and stops. I don't remember Ron doing anything. But after a second or two, he walks to him again and puts his hand there. Fraser. And Ron looked at him. Oh my God, and what, Kurt, whatever.
Yeah.
And they'd been at university together.
That is amazing.
It's incredible.
And as you say, two years previously, just two years,
but
two years before
in a reasonably short time. I don't know exactly how long.
No.
What would Ron have, well, it might have been a bit longer than that, but I should say Ron was, I'm a W-year-old, only a kid, but Ron would be about 28, I should think, so it could have been a few years before,
yes.
But to the extent they recognised each other.
Yes, yes. Was he an important, was he sort of one of the top doctors?
Oh, no, he was, he was the medic.
Right,
on duty at that time.
Oh, right.
You see, generally speaking, the German, particularly the German Air Force, they applied the Geneva Convention to a letter
to
British airmen,
yes.
And I'm sure we did the same. And if somebody needed medical attention, they got it.
Mm.
You know, we were given changes of clothing and so forth.
Yes.
You know.
But I suppose that must have been quite sort of quite pleasing for you all to know that there was somebody who knew one of you. And
bear in mind, you don't know what to expect.
Oh, no.
So, shall I say, it was quite a nice surprise.
Yes.
You know, if the rest of prisoner of war life is going to be like this, it's all right with us.
Yes. So what happened then, Bert? How long were you in the...
Only 48 hours, two days, and 2 days later, then they were going to take us from Brest, or just outside Brest, up to near Cologne. Gulagluft, which is the interrogation centre for aircrew.
Right.
And they took us up by train. I remember we got into Paris, and we were going to change train. Oh, sorry. The guards they gave us, there were six of us, and we got 12 guards. We got two guards for each of us, you see. And we were... changed trains out of Paris. And that's it sounds now. I walked off the station. There were so many people moving about.
Yes.
And I didn't know I'd walked off the station. When I realised I was outside, I looked for the guards. There were no guards.
So that could have been your big break?
Well, it was to me. You know, I'm free.
Yes.
Well, again, what do you do? Do you make a mad dash? If you do, where?
Yes.
You see, so I just thought, well, if they haven't thought anything about it. And incidentally, one of the things you must bear in mind, the variety of uniforms that you saw in Germany.
Yes. So
the dustman was smartly attired in the general's hat, and so forth.
So did you still have your flying kit?
Not my flying kit, the jacket, but my uniform, my Air Force uniform.
So if you'd made a run for it, you'd have been a...
Well, I was just a marked man. I got flying boots on as well.
Yes.
But eventually a gendarme saw me, and he got a revolver out, and that was it.
Yeah.
You know, but I've often said to me, I escaped before I was captured.
Yes.
You know. And then they took us up to... Dulagluft, which was an interrogation centre, solely equipped for that.
Right.
To interrogate aircrew.
Was there other aircrew with you at the time, or were you just the six of you coming from?
On that train.
That train, yes.
Six,
yeah.
But of course, in Dulagluft, there were about 150 at the time.
Yeah.
It had got its own mess, canteen, a naffy, where you could buy it, because they gave you Germans money, they gave you prisoner of war money, which you could buy things. And you were kept in there for 3 days, interrogated for 2 days, and the one thing I remember about the interrogation, bear in mind, the interrogation officers, they spoke better English than you and me.
Yeah.
Perfect. And we knew name, rank, service number, so we walked in to be interrogated, the first thing he offered you was a cigarette at 20 gold flakes. Well, ever spirit. Make a few of these. And I'd been flung, and this bloke suddenly gets up. Stand up, so I stood up, and he thumped me and knocked us to the left, you see. And he said, now, let's get down to detail. You're on 61 Squadron. You were flying from North Luffenham.
Yeah.
You see. You came out with a special bomb to attack the Pocketman. He was telling me exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, do you remember that? Perfect English. Then incidentally, there's another thing I ought to tell you. Before you were interviewed, you were put in solitary confinement for 48 hours. And you believe me, people laugh at me when I say this, but I'm sincere. There's nothing more deafening than total silence.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
You want any sound, you listen to any sound.
Yeah.
But all you need is air.
Yeah.
And the little cell room in blackout as well, total darkness.
Yeah.
That's to weaken you a little bit.
Yeah. Before you were captured, did you ever have any training in how to handle being captured and
not
interrogation?
You wouldn't say training.
You were told.
You were told it might happen.
Yeah.
Obviously, you were told you weren't
to divulge.
That's right.
Yeah.
You weren't to give any useful information.
Yeah. Right. So name, rank, and number
that was it.
Yeah.
But of course, I was.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, I. He told me certain things,
yeah,
which I elaborated a bit on, and that's when he lost his temper.
Yes, yes.
Because one thing he said to him, of course you were in Lincolnshire, weren't you? Well, not far away, Yorkshire. Things like that,
yes,
you see.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So, what happened, so interrogation there, where did you go from there?
Then to Stelly 8B,
right,
which is in Far Eastern. Far Eastern Germany, the bit at the time which was got Poland in the north, and the bit which it's almost in Russia, Far Eastern Germany.
Czechoslovakia,
isn't it? That's a Poland,
Czechoslovakia,
which is 8B, Stalag 8B, which is an army camp.
Right.
It was equipped to hold 30,000 army, and there were just the Air Force Center of 1,000 airmen. Well, it's air group.
Right.
Right. In an army camp.
Right.
And I wouldn't say we were isolated, but we were on our own.
Yes.
You know, we didn't have to parade with them, they didn't have to parade with us.
So you weren't interrogated anymore, they in fact knew everything about you anyway. They knew the whole...
They were telling us.
Right. So was that where you stayed for the duration of the war? Was that
until May 45, when they marched us back. One of my memories was... prisoner of war camp, they say there were 30,000 army attached to this camp, 20,000 out working, 10,000 in the camp at any one time, and they were brought in and swapped.
Right.
Continue like that. And you're on compounds, 100 yards square each way, and 12 foot of barbed wire, double barbed wire, round each one, with bolt of barbed wire.
Right.
Now, we arrived there in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
Snow.
Yeah.
So, to save themselves some time, they put drift boards down the wires. Just let the snow drifted up the drift boards where it
didn't
get
come into the camp.
And of course, that's what we have. That's always, every parade, we hear hell of a commotion from this compound just beneath us, below them. All with a commotion, every parade. I've got a clue what it was. And when the drift boards came down, we saw what it was. And they were our repats. They bolted one arm, no legs, one leg, blinded. And they played, then they'd have been playing the Germans up the way they had. And you believe me, people have laughed at me when I've said it. I felt a bloody lot better when I saw it. But if they can put up with it,
then
I know I can.
Yeah.
And a lot of us felt that way.
Yes.
Did it a lot of good.
Yeah.